and hot hand, they're rare, so rare that they make little to no dent in the kind of statistics contemplated by GVT. A fund that's beaten the market 5 years running is vastly more likely to have been lucky than good. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. If Michigan fans were counting on Spike Albrecht to carry the team all the way to a championship, they were badly disappointed. Albrecht missed every shot he took in the second half, and the Wolverines ended up losing by 6. A 2009 study by John Heisinger and Sandy Weil suggests that it might be a good idea for players to disbelieve in the hot hand, even if it really exists. In a much larger dataset than GVT's, they found a similar effect. After making a basket, players were less likely to succeed on their next shot. But Heisinger and Weil had records of not only shot success, but shot location. And that data showed a striking potential explanation. Players who had just made a shot were more likely to take a more difficult shot on their next attempt. Yigal Atali, in 2013, found even more intriguing results along these lines. A player who made a layup was no more likely to shoot from distance than a player who just missed a layup. Layups are easy and shouldn't give the player a strong sense of being hot, but a player is much more likely to try a long shot after a three-point basket than after a three-point miss. In other words, the hot hand might cancel itself out. Players, believing themselves to be hot, get overconfident and take shots they shouldn't. The nature of the analogous phenomenon in stock investment is left as an exercise for the reader. Chapter 8. Reductio ad unlikely. The stickiest philosophical point in a significance test comes right at the beginning, before we run any of the sophisticated algorithms developed by Fisher and honed by his successors. It's right there at the beginning of step 2. Suppose the null hypothesis is true. But what we're trying to prove in most cases is that the null hypothesis isn't true. The drug works, Shakespeare alliterates, the Torah knows the future. It seems very logically fishy to assume exactly what we're aiming to disprove, as if we're in danger of making a circular argument. On this point, you can rest easy. Assuming the truth of something we quietly believe to be false is a time-honored method of argument that goes all the way back to Aristotle. It is the proof by contradiction, or reductio ad absurdum. The reductio is a kind of mathematical judo in which we first affirm what we wish eventually to deny, with a plan of throwing it over our shoulder and defeating it by means of its own force. If a hypothesis implies a falsehood, then the hypothesis itself must be false. So the plan goes like this. Suppose the hypothesis H is true. It follows from H that a certain fact F cannot be the case. But F is the case. Therefore, H is false. Say someone exclaims to you that 200 children were killed by gunfire in the District of Columbia in 2012. That's a hypothesis. But it might be somewhat hard to check, by which I mean that I typed number of children killed by guns in D.C. in 2012 into the Google search bar and did not immediately learn the answer. On the other hand, if we assume the hypothesis is correct, then there cannot have been any fewer than 200 homicides in total in D.C. in 2012. But there were fewer. In fact, there were only 88. So the exclaimer's hypothesis must have been wrong. There's no circularity here. We've assumed the false hypothesis in a kind of tentative, exploratory way, setting up the counterfactual mental world in which H is so, and then watching it collapse under pressure from reality. Put this way, the reductio sounds almost trivial, and in a sense it is, but maybe it's more accurate to say it's a mental tool we've grown so used to handling that we forget how powerful it is. In fact, it's a simple reductio that drives the Pythagorean's proof of the irrationality of the square root of 2, the one so awesomely paradigm-busting they had to kill its author. A proof so simple, refined, and compact that I can write it out whole in a page. You can think of the null hypothesis significance test as a sort of fuzzy version of the reductio. Suppose the null hypothesis H is true. It follows from H that a certain outcome O is very improbable, say less than Fisher's 0.05 threshold. But O was actually observed. Therefore, H is very improbable. Not a reductio ad absurdum, in other words, but a reductio ad unlikely. A classical example comes from the 18th century astronomer and clergyman John Michell, among the first to take a statistical approach to the study of the heavenly bodies. The cluster of dim stars in one corner of the constellation Taurus has been observed by just about every civilization. The Navajo call them Dilyehe, the sparkling figure. The Maori call them Matariki, the eyes of God. To the ancient Romans, they were a bunch of grapes. And in Japanese, they're Subaru, in case you ever wondered where the car company's six-star logo came from. We call them the Pleiades. All these centuries of observation and myth-making couldn't answer the fundamental scientific question about the Pleiades. Is the cluster actually a cluster? Or are the six stars separated by unfathomable distances, but arrayed by chance in almost the exact same direction from Earth? Here's the difficulty. Points of light placed at random in our frame of vision look clumpy. That's to be expected. There will inevitably be some groups of stars that wind up almost on top of one another simply by happenstance. How can we be sure that's not what's going on with the Pleiades? It's the same phenomenon Gilovich, Vallone, and Tversky pointed out. A perfectly consistent point guard who enjoys no hot streaks and suffers no slumps will nonetheless sometimes nail 5 shots in a row. In fact, if there were no big visible clusters of stars, that itself would be evidence that some non-random process was at work. The second situation might look more random to the naked eye, but it is not. It testifies that the points have a built-in disinclination to crowd. So the mere appearance of an apparent cluster shouldn't convince us that the stars in question are actually clumped together in space. On the other hand, a group of stars in the sky might be so tightly packed as to demand that one doubt it could have happened by chance. Mitchell showed that, were visible stars randomly strewn around in space, the chance that 6 would array themselves so neatly as to present a Pleiades-like cluster to our eyes was small indeed, about 1 in 500,000 by his computation. But there they are above us, the tightly packed bunch of grapes. Only a fool, Mitchell concluded, could believe it had happened by chance. Fisher wrote approvingly of Mitchell's work, making explicit the analogy he saw there between Mitchell's argument and the classical reductio, writing, "The force with which such a conclusion is supported is logically that of a simple disjunction. Either an exceptionally rare chance has occurred, or the theory of random distribution is not true." The argument is compelling and its conclusion correct. The Pleiades are indeed no optical coincidence, but a real cluster of several hundred adolescent stars, not just the 6 visible to the eye. The fact that we see many very tight clusters of stars like the Pleiades, much tighter than would be likely to exist by chance, is good evidence that the stars are not placed randomly, but rather are clumped by some real physical phenomenon out there in the void. But here's the bad news. The reductio ad unlikely, unlike its Aristotelian ancestor, is not logically sound in general. It leads us into its own absurdities. Joseph Berkson, the longtime head of the medical statistics division at the Mayo Clinic, who cultivated and loudly broadcast a vigorous skepticism about methodology he thought shaky, offered a famous example demonstrating the pitfalls of the method. Suppose you have a group of 50 experimental subjects, who you hypothesize, that's H, are human beings. You observe, that's O, that one of them is an albino. Now, albinism is extremely rare, affecting no more than 1 in 20,000 people. So given that H is correct, the chance you'd find an albino among your 50 subjects is quite small, less than 1 in 400 or 0.0025. So the p-value, the probability of observing O given H, is much lower than 0.05. We are inexorably led to conclude with a high degree of statistical confidence that H is incorrect. The subjects in the sample are not human beings. It's tempting to think of very improbable as meaning essentially impossible, and from there to utter the word essentially more and more quietly in our mind's voice until we stop paying attention to it. But impossible and improbable are not the same, not even close. Impossible things never happen, but improbable things happen a lot. That means we're on quivery logical footing when we try to make inferences from an improbable observation, as reductio ad unlikely asks us to. That time in North Carolina when the lottery combo 4, 21, 23, 34, 39 came up twice in a week raised a lot of questions Was something wrong with the game? But each combination of numbers is exactly as likely to come up as any other. For the numbers to show 4, 21, 23, 34, 39 on Tuesday and 16, 17, 18, 22, 39 on Thursday is precisely as improbable as what actually took place. There's just one chance in 300 billion or so of getting those two draws on those 2 days. In fact, any particular outcome of the Tuesday and Thursday lottery draws is a 1 in 300 billion shot. If you're committed to the view that a highly improbable outcome should lead you to question the fairness of the game, you're going to be the person shooting off an angry email to the lottery commissioner every Thursday of your life, no matter which numbered balls drop out of the cage. Don't be that person. Prime clusters and the structure of structurelessness. Mitchell's critical insight that clusters of stars might appear to our eye even if stars were randomly distributed around our field of vision doesn't apply only to the celestial sphere. This phenomenon was the hinge for the pilot episode of the math cop drama Numbers. A series of grisly attacks marked by pins on the wall map at HQ showed no clusters, ergo, a single cunning serial killer intentionally leaving space between victims, not an unconnected burst of psychos, was at work. It was somewhat contrived as a police story, but mathematically, it was perfectly correct. The appearance of clusters and random data offers insight even in situations where there is no real randomness at all, like the behavior of prime numbers. In 2013, Yitong Tom Zhang, a popular math lecturer at the University of New Hampshire, stunned the world of pure mathematics when he announced that he had proven the bounded gaps conjecture about the distribution of primes. Zhang had been a star student at Beijing University, but had never thrived after moving to the United States for his PhD in the 1980s. He hadn't published a paper since 2001. At one point, he left academic math entirely to sell sandwiches at Subway until a fellow former student from Beijing tracked him down and helped him get an untenured lectureship at UNH. To all outward appearances, he was washed up. So it came as a great surprise when he released a paper proving a theorem some of the biggest names in number theory had tried and failed to conquer. But the fact that the conjecture is true came as no surprise at all. Mathematicians have a reputation of being no BS hard cases who don't believe a thing until it's locked down and proved. That's not quite true. All of us believed the bounded gaps conjecture before Zhang's big reveal, and we all believe the closely related twin primes conjecture, even though it remains unproven. Why? Let's start with what the two conjectures say. The prime numbers are those numbers greater than 1 that aren't multiples of any number smaller than themselves and greater than 1. So 7 is a prime, but 9 is not because it's divisible by 3. The first few primes are 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, and 13. Every positive number can be expressed in just one way as a product of prime numbers. For instance, 60 is made up of 2 2s, 1 3, and 1 5, because 60 is 2 times 2 times 3 times 5. This is why we don't take 1 to be a prime, though some mathematicians have done so in the past. It breaks the uniqueness, because if 1 counts as prime, 60 could be written as 2 times 2 times 3 times 5, and 1 times 2 times 2 times 3 times 5, and 1 times 1 times 2 times 2 times 3 times 5, and so on. What about prime numbers themselves? They're fine. A prime number, like 13, is the product of a single prime, 13 itself. And what about 1? We've excluded it from our list of primes, so how can it be a product of primes, each one of which is larger than 1? Simple. 1 is the product of no primes. At this point, I'm sometimes asked, why is the product of no primes 1 and not 0? Here's one slightly convoluted explanation. If you take the product of some set of primes, like 2 and 3, but then divide away the very primes you multiplied, you ought to be left with the product of nothing at all, and 6 divided by 6 is 1, not 0. The sum of no numbers, on the other hand, is indeed 0. The primes are the atoms of number theory, the basic indivisible entities of which all numbers are made. As such, they've been the object of intense study ever since number theory started. One of the first theorems ever proved in number theory is that of Euclid, which tells us that the primes are infinite in number. We will never run out, no matter how far along the number line we let our minds range. But mathematicians are greedy types, not inclined to be satisfied with a mere assertion of infinitude. After all, there's infinite, and then there's infinite. There are infinitely many powers of 2, but they're very rare. Among the first 1,000 numbers, there are only 10 of them. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, and 512. There are infinitely many even numbers, too, but they're much more common, exactly 500 out of the first 1,000 numbers. In fact, it's pretty apparent that out of the first n numbers, where n is any value, just about one-half n will be even. Primes, it turns out, are intermediate, more common than the powers of 2, but rarer than even numbers. Among the first n numbers, about n divided by log n are prime. This is the prime number theorem, proven at the end of the 19th century by the number theorists Jacques Adamard and Charles-Jean de La Vallée-Poussin. A note on the logarithm and the flogarithm. It has come to my attention that hardly anybody knows what the logarithm is. Let me take a step toward fixing this. The logarithm of a positive number n, called log n, is the number of digits it has. Wait, really? That's it? No, that's not really it. We can call the number of digits the fake logarithm, or flogarithm. It's close enough to the real thing to give the general idea of what the logarithm means in a context like this one. The flogarithm, whence also the logarithm, is a very slowly growing function indeed. The flogarithm of 1,000 is 4, the flogarithm of 1,000,000, 1,000 times greater, is 7, and the flogarithm of 1,000,000,000 is still only 10. By the way, the real definition of log n is that number of x such that e to the x equals n. Here, e is Euler's number, whose value is about 2.71828. I say e and not 10 because the logarithm we mean to talk about is the natural logarithm, not the common or base 10 logarithm. The natural logarithm is the one you always use if you're a mathematician or if you have e fingers. Now back to prime clusters. The prime number theorem says that, among the first n integers, a proportion of about 1 over log n of them are prime. In particular, prime numbers get less and less common as the numbers get bigger, though the decrease is very slow. A random number with 20 digits is half as likely to be prime as a random number with 10 digits. Naturally, one imagines that the more common a certain type of number, the smaller the gaps between instances of that type of number. If you're looking at an even number, you never have to travel farther than 2 numbers forward to encounter the next even. In fact, the gaps between the even numbers are always exactly of size 2. For the powers of 2, it's a different story. The gaps between successive powers of 2 grow exponentially, getting bigger and bigger with no retreats as you traverse the sequence. Once you get past 16, for instance, you will never again see 2 powers of 2 separated by a gap of size 15 or less. Those two problems are easy, but the question of gaps between consecutive primes is harder. It's so hard that, even after Zhang's breakthrough, it remains a mystery in many respects. And yet, we think we know what to expect, thanks to a remarkably fruitful point of view. We think of primes as random numbers. The reason the fruitfulness of this viewpoint is so remarkable is that the viewpoint is so very, very false. Primes are not random. Nothing about them is arbitrary or subject to chance. Quite the opposite. We take them as immutable features of the universe and carve them on the golden records we shoot out into interstellar space to prove to the ETs that we're no dopes. The primes are not random, but it turns out that in many ways, they act as if they were. For example, when you divide a random whole number by 3, the remainder is either 0, 1, or 2, and each case arises equally often. When you divide a big prime number by 3, the quotient can't come out even, otherwise the so-called prime would be divisible by 3, which would mean it wasn't really a prime at all. But an old theorem of Dirichlet tells us that remainder 1 shows up about equally as often as remainder 2, just as is the case for random numbers. So as far as remainder when divided by 3 goes, prime numbers, apart from not being multiples of 3, look random. What about the gaps between consecutive primes? You might think that because prime numbers get rarer and rarer as numbers get bigger, that they also get farther and farther apart. On average, that's indeed the case. But what Zhang proved is that there are infinitely many pairs of primes that differ by at most 70 million. In other words, that the gap between one prime and the next is bounded by 70 million, infinitely often, thus the bounded gaps conjecture. Why 70 million? Just because that's what Zhang was able to prove. In fact, the release of his paper set off an explosion of activity, with mathematicians from around the world working together in a polymath, a sort of frenzied online math kibbutz, to narrow the gap still more using variations on Zhang's method. By July 2013, the collective had shown that there were infinitely many gaps of size at most 5,414. In November, a just-fledged PhD in Montreal, James Maynard, knocked the bound down to 600, and Polymath scrambled into action to combine his insights with those of the hive. By the time you hear this, the bound will no doubt be smaller still. On first glance, the bounded gaps might seem a miraculous phenomenon. If the primes are tending to be farther and farther apart, what's causing there to be so many pairs that are close together? Is it some kind of prime gravity? Nothing of the kind. If you strew numbers at random, it's very likely that some pairs will, by chance, land very close together, just as points dropped randomly in a plane form visible clusters. It's not hard to compute that if prime numbers behaved like random numbers, you'd see precisely the behavior that Zhang demonstrated. Even more, you'd expect to see infinitely many pairs of primes that are separated by only two, like 3 and 5, or 11 and 13. These are the so-called twin primes, whose infinitude remains conjectural. Among the first n numbers, the prime number theorem tells us that about n over log n of them are primes. If these were distributed randomly, each number k would have a 1 over log n chance of being prime. The chance that k and k plus 2 are both prime should thus be about 1 over log n times 1 over log n, or 1 over log n squared. So how many pairs of primes separated by 2 should we expect to see? There are about n pairs, k, k plus 2, in the range of interest, and each one has a 1 over log n squared chance of being a twin prime, so one should expect to find about n over log n squared twin primes in the interval. There are some deviations from pure randomness whose small effects number theorists know how to handle. The main point is that k being prime and k plus 2 being prime are not independent events. K being prime makes it somewhat more likely that k plus 2 is prime, which means our use of the product 1 over log n times 1 over log n isn't quite right. One issue, if k is prime and bigger than 2, it's odd, which means k plus 2 is odd as well, which makes k plus 2 more likely to be prime. G.H. Hardy, of the Unnecessary Perplexities, together with his lifelong collaborator J.E. Littlewood, worked out a more refined prediction, taking these dependencies into account and predicting that the number of twin primes should in fact be about 32% greater than n over log n squared. This better approximation gives a prediction that the number of twin primes less than a quadrillion should be about 1.1 trillion, a pretty good match for the actual figure of 1,177,209,242,304. That's a lot of twin primes. And a lot of twin primes is exactly what number theorists expect to find, no matter how big the numbers get. Not because we think there's a deep, miraculous structure hidden in the primes, but precisely because we don't think so. We expect the primes to be tossed around at random, like dirt. If the twin primes conjecture were false, that would be a miracle, requiring that some hitherto unknown force was pushing the primes apart. Not to pull back the curtain too much, but a lot of famous conjectures in number theory work this way. The Goldbach conjecture, that every even number greater than 2 is the sum of two primes, is another one that would have to be true if primes behaved like random numbers. So is the conjecture that the primes contain arithmetic progressions of any desired length, whose resolution by Ben Green and Terry Tao in 2004 helped win Tao a Fields Medal. The most famous of all is the conjecture made by Pierre de Fermat in 1637, which asserted that the equation a to the n plus b to the n equals c to the n has no solutions with a, b, c, and n positive whole numbers with n greater than 2. When n is equal to 2, there are lots of solutions, like 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Everybody strongly believed the Fermat conjecture was true, just as we believe the twin primes conjecture now. But no one knew how to prove it until the breakthrough of Princeton mathematician Andrew Wiles in the 1990s. We believed it because perfect nth powers are very rare, and the chance of finding two numbers that summed to a third in a random set of such extreme scarcity is next to nil. Even more, most people believe that there are no solutions to the generalized Fermat equation, a to the p plus b to the q equals c to the r, when the exponents p, q, and r are big enough. A banker in Dallas named Andrew Beal will give you $1 million if you can prove that the equation has no solutions for which p, q, and r are all greater than 3, and a, b, and c share no prime factor. This last condition may seem a bit out of the blue, but it turns out there's a cheap way to generate lots of uninteresting solutions if you allow common factors among a, b, and c. I fully believe that the statement is true because it would be true if perfect powers were random, but I think we'll have to understand something truly new about numbers before we can make our way to a proof. I spent a couple of years, along with a bunch of collaborators, proving that the generalized Fermat equation has no solution with p equals 4, q equals 2, and r bigger than 4. Just for that one case, we had to develop some novel techniques, and it's clear they won't be enough to cover the full million-dollar problem. Despite the apparent simplicity of the bounded gaps conjecture, Zhang's proof requires some of the deepest theorems of modern mathematics. Building on the work of many predecessors, Zhang is able to prove that the prime numbers look random in the first way we mentioned, concerning the remainders obtained after division by many different integers. From there, he can show that the prime numbers look random in a totally different sense, having to do with the sizes of the gaps between them. Random is random. Zhang's success, along with related work of other contemporary big shots like Ben Green and Terry Tao, points to a prospect even more exciting than any individual result about primes, that we might, in the end, be on our way to developing a richer theory of randomness. Say, a way of specifying precisely what we mean when we say that numbers act as if randomly scattered with no governing structure, despite arising from completely deterministic processes. How wonderfully paradoxical. What helps us break down the final mysteries about prime numbers may be new mathematical ideas that structure the concept of structurelessness itself. Chapter 9. The International Journal of Haruspicy. Here's a parable I learned from the statistician Cosma Shalizi. Imagine yourself a haruspex. That is, your profession is to make predictions about future events by sacrificing sheep and then examining the features of their entrails, especially their livers. You do not, of course, consider your predictions to be reliable merely because you follow the practices commanded by the Etruscan deities. That would be ridiculous. You require evidence. And so you and your colleagues submit all your work to the peer-reviewed International Journal of Haruspicy, which demands without exception that all published results clear the bar of statistical significance. Haruspicy, especially rigorous evidence-based haruspicy, is not an easy gig. For one thing, you spend a lot of your time spattered with blood and bile. For another, a lot of your experiments don't work. You try to use sheep guts to predict the price of apple stock, and you fail. You try to model democratic vote share among Hispanics, and you fail. You try to estimate global oil supply, and you fail again. The gods are very picky, and it's not always clear precisely which arrangement of the internal organs and which precise incantations will reliably unlock the future. Sometimes, different haruspices run the same experiment, and it works for one but not the other. Who knows why? It's frustrating. Some days you feel like chucking it all and going to law school. But it's all worth it for those moments of discovery where everything works and you find that the texture and protrusions of the liver really do predict the severity of the following year's flu season, and with a silent thank you to the gods, you publish. You might find this happens about one time in 20. That's what I'd expect anyway, because I, unlike you, don't believe in haruspicy. I think the sheep's guts don't know anything about the flu data, and when they match up, it's just luck. In other words, in every matter concerning divination from entrails, I'm a proponent of the null hypothesis. So in my world, it's pretty unlikely that any given horospectic experiment will succeed. How unlikely? The standard threshold for statistical significance, and thus for publication in the journal, is fixed by convention to be a p-value of 0.05, or 1 in 20. Remember the definition of the p-value. This says precisely that if the null hypothesis is true for some particular experiment, then the chance that that experiment will nonetheless return a statistically significant result is only 1 in 20. If the null hypothesis is always true, that is, if haruspicy is undiluted hocus-pocus, then only 1 in 20 experiments will be publishable. And yet, there are hundreds of haruspices and thousands of ripped open sheep, and even 1 in 20 divinations provides plenty of material to fill each issue of the journal with novel results demonstrating the efficacy of the methods and the wisdom of the gods. A protocol that worked in one case and gets published usually fails when another haruspex tries it. But experiments without statistically significant results don't get published, so no one ever finds out about the failure to replicate. And even if word starts getting around, there are always small differences the experts can point to that explain why the follow-up study didn't succeed. After all, we know the protocol works because we tested it and it had a statistically significant effect. Modern medicine and social science are not haruspicy. But a steadily louder drum circle of dissident scientists has been pounding out an uncomfortable message in recent years. There's probably a lot more entrail reading in the sciences than we'd like to admit. The loudest drummer is John Ioannidis, a Greek high school math star turned biomedical researcher whose 2005 paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, touched off a fierce bout of self-criticism and a second wave of self-defense in the clinical sciences. Some papers plead for attention with a title more dramatic than the claims made in the body, but not this one. Ioannidis takes seriously the idea that entire specialties of medical research are null fields like haruspicy in which there are simply no actual effects to be found. It can be proven, he writes, that most claimed research findings are false. Proven is a little more than this mathematician is willing to swallow, but Ioannidis certainly makes a strong case that his radical claim is not implausible. The story goes like this. In medicine, most interventions we try won't work, and most associations we test for are going to be absent. Think about tests of genetic association with diseases. There are lots of genes on the genome, and most of them don't give you cancer or depression or make you fat or have any recognizable direct effect at all. Ioannidis asks us to consider the case of genetic influence on schizophrenia. Such an influence is almost certain, given what we know about the heritability of the disorder. But where is it on the genome? Researchers might cast their net wide. It's the big data era, after all. Looking at 100,000 genes, more precisely genetic polymorphisms, to see which ones are associated with schizophrenia. Ioannidis suggests that around 10 of these actually have some clinically relevant effect. And the other 99,990? They've got nothing to do with schizophrenia, but 1 in 20 of them, or just about 5,000, are going to pass the p-value test of statistical significance. In other words, among the OMG I found the schizophrenia gene results that might get published, there are 500 times as many bogus ones as real ones. And that's assuming that all the genes that really do have an effect on schizophrenia pass the test. As we saw with Shakespeare and basketball, it's very possible for a real effect to be rejected as statistically insignificant if the study isn't high-powered enough to find it. If the studies are underpowered, the genes that truly do make a difference might pass the significance test only half the time. But that means that of the genes certified by p-value to cause schizophrenia, only 5 really do so, as against the 5,000 pretenders that passed the test by luck alone. The significance test isn't the problem. It's doing exactly the job it's built to do. The genes that don't affect schizophrenia very rarely pass the test, while the genes we're really interested in pass half the time. But the non-active genes are so massively preponderant that the circle of false positives, while small relative to the true negatives, is much larger than the circle of true positives. Doctor, it hurts when I p-value. And it gets worse. A low-powered study is only going to be able to see a pretty big effect. But sometimes you know that the effect if it exists, is small. In other words, a study that accurately measures the effect of a gene is likely to be rejected as statistically insignificant, while any result that passes the p less than 0.05 test is either a false positive or a true positive that massively overstates the gene's effect. Low power is a special danger in fields where small studies are common and effect sizes are typically modest. A recent paper in Psychological Science, a premier psychological journal, found that married women were significantly more likely to support Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential candidate, when they were in the fertile portion of their ovulatory cycle. Of those women queried during their peak fertility period, 40.4% expressed support for Romney, while only 23.4% of the married women polled at infertile times were pulling the lever for Mitt. By the way, I was disappointed to find that this study has not yet spawned any conspiracy videos claiming that Obama's support of birth control coverage was aimed at suppressing women's biological drive to vote GOP during ovulation. Get on the stick, conspiracy video producers. The sample is small, just 228 women, but the difference is big, big enough that the result passes the p-value test with a score of 0.03. Which is just the problem. The difference is too big. Is it really plausible that among married women who dig Mitt Romney, nearly half spend a large part of each month supporting Barack Obama? Wouldn't anyone notice? If there's really a political swing to the right once ovulation kicks in, it seems likely to be substantially smaller. But the relatively small size of the study means a more realistic assessment of the strength of the effect would have been rejected, paradoxically, by the p-value filter. In other words, we can be quite confident that the large effect reported in the study is mostly or entirely just noise in the signal. But noise is just as likely to push you in the opposite direction from the real effect as it is to tell the truth. So we're left in the dark by a result that offers plenty of statistical significance, but very little confidence. Scientists call this problem the winner's curse, and it's one reason that impressive and loudly touted experimental results often melt into disappointing sludge when the experiments are repeated. In a representative case, a team of scientists led by psychologist Christopher Chabris studied 13 single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, in the genome that had been observed in previous studies to have statistically significant correlations with IQ scores. We know that the ability to do well on IQ-type tests is somewhat heritable, so it's not unreasonable to look for genetic markers. But when Chabris' team tested those SNPs against IQ measures in large datasets, like the 10,000-person Wisconsin longitudinal study, every single one of those associations vanished into insignificance. If they're real at all, they're almost certainly too small for even a big trial to detect. Genomicists nowadays believe that heritability of IQ scores is probably not concentrated in a few smarty-pants genes, but rather accumulates from numerous genetic features, each one having a tiny effect. Which means that if you go hunting for large effects of individual polymorphisms, you'll succeed at the same 1 in 20 rate as do the entrail readers. Even Ioannidis doesn't really think that only 1 in 1,000 published papers is correct. Most scientific studies don't consist of blundering around the genome at random. They test hypotheses that the researchers have some pre-existing reason to think might be true. But the crisis of replicability is real. In a 2012 study, scientists at the California biotech company Amgen set out to replicate some of the most famous experimental results in the biology of cancer, 53 studies in all. In their independent trials, they were able to reproduce only 6. How can this have happened? It's not because genomicists and cancer researchers are dopes. In part, the replicability crisis is simply a reflection of the fact that science is hard and that most ideas we have are wrong, even most of those ideas that survive a first round of prodding. But there are practices in the world of science that make the crisis worse, and those can be changed. For one thing, we're doing publishing wrong. Suppose you tested 20 genetic markers to see whether they were associated with some disorder of interest, and you found just one result that achieved p less than 0.05 significance. Being a mathematical sophisticate, you'd recognize that one success in 20 is exactly what you'd expect if none of the markers had any effect. All the more so if you tested the same gene 20 times and got a statistically significant effect just once. But what if the gene were tested 20 times by 20 different research groups in 20 different labs? 19 of the labs find no statistically significant effect. They don't write up their results. Who cares about experiments that don't work? The scientists in the 20th lab, the lucky ones, find a statistically significant effect because they got lucky, but they don't know they got lucky. For all they can tell, their theory has been tested only once, and it passed. If you make decisions based on just the papers that get published, you are making the same mistake the Army made when they counted the bullet holes on the planes that came back from Germany. As Abraham Wald pointed out, if you want an honest view of what's going on, you also have to consider the planes that didn't come back. This is the so-called file drawer problem. A scientific field has a drastically distorted view of the evidence for a hypothesis when public dissemination is cut off by a statistical significance threshold. But we've already given the problem another name. It's the Baltimore stockbroker. The lucky scientist excitedly preparing a press release about the winning gene is just like the naive investor mailing off his life savings to the crooked broker. The investor, like the scientist, gets to see the one rendition of the experiment that went well by chance, but is blind to the much larger group of experiments that failed. There's one big difference, though. In science, there's no shady con man and no innocent victim. When the scientific community file drawers its failed experiments, it plays both parts at once. They're running the con on themselves. And all this is assuming that the scientists in question are playing fair. But that doesn't always happen. Remember the wiggle room problem that ensnared the Bible coders? Scientists, subject to the intense pressure to publish lest they perish, are not immune to the same wiggly temptations. If you run your analysis and get a p-value of 0.06, you're supposed to conclude that your results are statistically insignificant. But it takes a lot of mental strength to stuff years of work in the file drawer. After all, don't the numbers for that one experimental subject look a little screwy? Probably an outlier, maybe try deleting that line of the spreadsheet. Did we control for age? Did we control for the weather outside? Did we control for age and the weather outside? Give yourself license to tweak and shade the statistical tests you carry out on your results, and you can often get that 0.06 down to a 0.04. Yuri Simonson, a professor at Penn who's a leader in the study of replicability, calls these practices p-hacking. Hacking the p isn't usually as crude as I've made it out to be, and it's seldom malicious. The p-hackers truly believe in their hypotheses, just as the Bible coders do. And when you're a believer, it's easy to come up with reasons that the analysis that gives a publishable p-value is the one you should have done in the first place. But everybody knows it's not really right. When they don't think anyone's listening, scientists call this practice torturing the data until it confesses. And the reliability of the results are about what you'd expect from confessions extracted by force. Assessing the scale of the p-hacking problem is not so easy. You can't examine the papers that are hidden in the file drawer or were simply never written, just as you can't examine the downed planes in Germany to see where they were hit. But you can, like Abraham Wald, make some inferences about data you can't measure directly. Think again about the International Journal of Haruspicy. What would you see if you looked at every paper ever published there and recorded the p-values you found? Remember, in this case, the null hypothesis is always true because haruspicy doesn't work, so 5% of experiments will record a p-value of 0.05 or below, 4% will score 0.04 or below, 3% will score 0.03 or below, and so on. Another way to say this is that the number of experiments yielding a p-value between 0.04 and 0.05 should be about the same as the number scoring between 0.03 and 0.04, between 0.02 and 0.03, and so on. If you plotted all the p-values reported in all the papers, you'd see a flat graph. Now, what if you looked at a real journal? Hopefully, a lot of the phenomena you're hunting for are actually real, which makes it more likely that your experiments will get a good, which means low, p-value score. So the graph of the p-values ought to slope downward. Except that's not exactly what happens in real life. In fields ranging from political science to economics to psychology to sociology, statistical detectives have found a noticeable upward slope as the p-value approaches the 0.05 threshold. That slope is the shape of p-hacking. It tells you that a lot of experimental results that belong over on the unpublishable side of the p equals 0.05 boundary have been cajoled, prodded, tweaked, or just plain tortured until, at last, they end up just on the happy side of the line. That's good for the scientists who need publications, but it's bad for science. What if an author refuses to torture the data, or the torture fails to deliver the desired result, and the p-value stays stuck just above the all-important 0.05? There are workarounds. Scientists will twist themselves into elaborate verbal knots, trying to justify reporting a result that doesn't make it to statistical significance. They say the result is almost statistically significant, or leaning toward significance, or well-nigh significant, or at the brink of significance, or even tantalizingly that it hovers on the brink of significance. All these examples are drawn from the immense collection at the blog of health psychologist Matthew Hankins, a connoisseur of non-significant results. It's easy to make fun of the anguished researchers who resort to such phrases, but we should be hating on the game, not the players. It's not their fault that publication is conditioned on an all-or-nothing threshold. To live or die by the 0.05 is to make a basic category error. Treating a continuous variable, how much evidence do we have that the drug works, the gene predicts IQ, fertile women like Republicans, as if it were a binary one, true or false, yes or no. Scientists should be allowed to report statistically insignificant data. In some settings, they may even be compelled to. In a 2010 opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Matrix, the maker of the cold remedy Zicam, was required to reveal that some users of its product had suffered anosmia, a loss of the sense of smell. The court's opinion, written by Sonia Sotomayor, held that even though the reports of anosmia didn't pass the significance test, they still contributed to the total mix of information investors in a company can reasonably expect to have available. A result with a weak p-value may provide only a little evidence, but a little is better than none. A result with a strong p-value might provide more evidence, but as we've seen, it's far from a certification that the claimed effect is real. There is nothing special, after all, about the value 0.05. It's purely arbitrary, a convention chosen by Fisher. There's value in convention. A single threshold, agreed on by all, ensures that we know what we're talking about when we say the word significant. I once read a paper by Robert Rector and Kirk Johnson of the Conservative Heritage Foundation complaining that a rival team of scientists had falsely claimed that abstinence pledges made no difference in teen rates of sexually transmitted diseases. In fact, the teens in the study who'd pledged to wait for their wedding night did have a slightly lower rate of STDs than the rest of the sample, but the difference wasn't statistically significant. The heritagists had a point. The evidence that pledges worked was weak, but not entirely absent. On the other hand, Rector and Johnson write in another paper concerning a statistically insignificant relationship between race and poverty that they wish to dismiss. If a variable is not statistically significant, it means that the variable has no statistically discernible difference between the coefficient value and zero, so there is no effect. What's good for the abstinent goose is good for the racially charged gander. The value of convention is that it enforces some discipline on researchers, guarding them from the temptation to let their own preferences determine which results count and which don't. But a conventional boundary, obeyed long enough, can be easily mistaken for an actual thing in the world. Imagine if we talked about the state of the economy this way. Economists have a formal definition of a recession, which depends on arbitrary thresholds, just as statistical significance does. One doesn't say, I don't care about the unemployment rate or housing starts or the aggregate burden of student loans or the federal deficit. If it's not a recession, we're not going to talk about it. One would be nuts to say so. The critics, and there are more of them and they are louder each year, say that a great deal of scientific practice is nuts in just this way. The detective, not the judge. It's clear that it's wrong to use p less than 0.05 as a synonym for true and p greater than 0.05 to mean false. Reductio ad unlikely, intuitively appealing as it is, just doesn't work as a principle for inferring the scientific truth underlying the data. But what's the alternative? If you've ever run an experiment, you know scientific truth doesn't pop out of the clouds blowing a flaming trumpet at you. Data is messy, and inference is hard. One simple and popular strategy, is to report confidence intervals in addition to p-values. This involves a slight widening of conceptual scope, asking us to consider not only the null hypothesis, but a whole range of alternatives. Perhaps you operate an online store that sells artisanal pinking shears. Being a modern person, except insofar as you make artisanal pinking shears, you set up an A-B test where half your users see the current version of your website, A, and half see a revamped version, B, with an animated pair of shears that does a little song and dance on top of the Buy Now button. And you find that purchases go up 10% with option B. Great! Now, if you're a sophisticated type, you might be worried about whether this increase was merely a matter of random fluctuation. So you compute a p-value, finding that the chance of getting a result this good if the redesign weren't actually working, that is, if the null hypothesis were correct, is a mere 0.03. By the way, all the numbers in this example are made up, partially because the actual computation of confidence intervals is more complicated than I'm revealing here. Why stop there? If I'm going to pay a college kid to superimpose dancing cutlery on all my pages, I want to know not only whether it works, but how well. Is the effect I saw consistent with the hypothesis that the redesign in the long term is really only improving my sales by 5%? Under that hypothesis, you might find that the probability of observing 10% growth is much more likely, say 0.2. In other words, the hypothesis that the redesign is 5% better is not ruled out by the reductio ad unlikely. On the other hand, you might optimistically wonder whether you got unlucky and the redesign was actually making your shears 25% more appealing. You compute another p-value and get 0.01, unlikely enough to induce you to throw out that hypothesis. The confidence interval is the range of hypotheses that the reductio doesn't demand that you trash, the ones that are reasonably consistent with the outcome you actually observed. In this case, the confidence interval might be the range from plus 3% to plus 17%. The fact that zero, the null hypothesis, is not included in the confidence interval is just to say that the results are statistically significant in the sense we described earlier in the chapter. But the confidence interval tells you a lot more. An interval of plus 3% to plus 17% licenses you to be confident that the effect is positive, but not that it's particularly large. An interval of plus 9% to plus 11%, on the other hand, suggests much more strongly that the effect is not only positive, but sizable. The confidence interval is also informative in cases where you don't get a statistically significant result, that is, where the confidence interval contains zero. If the confidence interval is negative 0.5% to plus 0.5%, then the reason you didn't get statistical significance is because you have good evidence the intervention doesn't do anything. If the confidence interval is negative 20% to positive 20%, the reason you didn't get statistical significance is because you have no idea whether the intervention has an effect or in which direction it goes. Those two outcomes look the same from the viewpoint of statistical significance, but have quite different implications for what you should do next. The development of the confidence interval is generally ascribed to Jerzy Neyman, another giant of early statistics. Neyman was a Pole who, like Abraham Wald, started as a pure mathematician in Eastern Europe before taking up the then-new practice of mathematical statistics and moving to the West. In the late 1920s, Neyman began collaborating with Egon Pearson, who had inherited from his father Carl both an academic position in London and a bitter academic feud with R.A. Fisher. Fisher was a difficult type, always ready for a fight, about whom his own daughter said, "He grew up without developing a sensitivity to the ordinary humanity of his fellows." In Neyman and Pearson, he found opponents sharp enough to battle him for decades. Their scientific differences are perhaps most starkly displayed in Neyman and Pearson's approach to the problem of inference. How to determine the truth from the evidence? Their startling response is to unask the question. For Neyman and Pearson, the purpose of statistics isn't to tell us what to believe, but to tell us what to do. Statistics is about making decisions, not answering questions. A significance test is no more or less than a rule which tells the people in charge whether to approve a drug, undertake a proposed economic reform, or tart up a website. It sounds crazy at first to deny that the goal of science is to find out what's true, but the Neyman-Pearson philosophy is not so far from reasoning we use in other spheres. What's the purpose of a criminal trial? We might naively say it's to find out whether the defendant actually committed the crime they're on trial for. But that's obviously wrong. There are rules of evidence which forbid the jury from hearing testimony obtained improperly, even if it might help them accurately determine the defendant's innocence or guilt. The purpose of a court is not truth, but justice. We have rules, the rules must be obeyed, and when we say that a defendant is guilty, we mean, if we are careful about our words, not that he committed the crime he's accused of, but that he was convicted fair and square according to those rules. Whatever rules we choose, we're going to let some criminals go free and imprison some of the blameless. The less you do of the first, the more you're likely to do of the second. So we try to design the rules in whatever way society thinks we best handle that fundamental trade-off. For Naaman and Pearson, science is like the court. When a drug fails a significance test, we don't say, we are quite certain the drug didn't work, but merely, the drug wasn't shown to work, and then dismiss it just as we would a defendant whose presence at the crime scene couldn't be established within reasonable doubt, even if every man and woman in the courthouse thinks he's guilty of sin. Fisher wanted none of this. For him, Naaman and Pearson stunk of pure mathematics, insisting on an austere rationalism at the expense of anything resembling scientific practice. Most judges wouldn't have the stomach to let an obviously innocent defendant meet the hangman, even when the rules in the book require it. And most practicing scientists have no interest in following a rigid sequence of instructions, denying themselves the self-polluting satisfaction of forming an opinion about which hypotheses are actually true. In a 1951 letter to W.E. Hick, Fisher wrote, "I am a little sorry that you have been worrying yourself at all with that unnecessary portentous approach to tests of significance represented by the Naaman and Pearson critical regions, etc. In fact, I and my pupils through the world would never think of using them. If I am asked to give an explicit reason for this, I should say they approach the problem entirely from the wrong end, i.e., not from the point of view of a research worker with a basis of well-grounded knowledge on which a very fluctuating population of conjectures and incoherent observations is continually under examination. What he needs is a competent answer to the question, ought I to take notice of that? This question can, of course, and for refinement of thought should, be framed as, is this particular hypothesis overthrown, and if so, at what level of significance by this particular body of observations? It can be put in this form unequivocally only because the genuine experimenter already has the answers to all the questions that the followers of Naaman and Pearson attempt, I think vainly, to answer by merely mathematical considerations." But Fisher certainly understood that clearing the significance bar wasn't the same thing as finding the truth. He envisions a richer, more iterated approach, writing in 1926, "A scientific fact should be regarded as experimentally established only if a properly designed experiment rarely fails to give this level of significance." Not succeeds once in giving, but rarely fails to give. A statistically significant finding gives you a clue, suggesting a promising place to focus your research energy. The significance test is the detective, not the judge. You know how when you read an article about a breakthrough finding that this thing causes that thing or that thing prevents the other thing, and at the end, there's always a banal sort of quote from a senior scientist not involved in the study, intoning some very minor variant of, "The finding is quite interesting and suggests that more research in this direction is needed," and how you don't really even read that part because you think of it as an obligatory warning without content? Here's the thing. The reason scientists always say that is because it's important and it's true. The provocative and oh-so-statistically significant finding isn't the conclusion of the scientific process, but the bare beginning. If a result is novel and important, other scientists in other laboratories ought to test and retest the phenomenon and its variants, trying to figure out whether the result was a one-time fluke or whether it truly meets the Fisherian standard of rarely fails. That's what scientists call replication. If an effect can't be replicated, despite repeated trials, science backs apologetically away. The replication process is supposed to be science's immune system, swarming over newly introduced objects and killing the ones that don't belong. That's the ideal, at any rate. In practice, science is a bit immunosuppressed. Some experiments, of course, are hard to repeat. If your study measures a 4-year-old's ability to delay gratification and then relates those measurements with life outcomes 30 years later, You can't just pop out a replication. But even studies that could be replicated often aren't. Every journal wants to publish a breakthrough finding, but who wants to publish